Hey, this is Josh Gates from Sci-Fi's Destination Truth, and you're listening to The Gaming Gang.
Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang, proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing Lock and Key from Cryptozoic Entertainment and Flat Acting from Eye Level Entertainment. Jeff will be reviewing Levé en Masse from Victory Point Games and Nuclear Winter 68 from Lock and Load Games. We'll have news, views, and much, much more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
And it's been 2 weeks. We're back.
We're back. Episode 40.
Yes, episode 40. Oof, gosh.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
You know, the other day I was just taking a peek to see how many audio programs we've done.
Uh-huh.
And of course, granted, there were 20-some of the daily shows that we did. We've got over 120.
Really? With all the extras and stuff? Nice.
I was like, oh my gosh. Ooh. We've been in front of the microphones that much? Yikes.
Oh, man. Suddenly I'm tired. Oh, jeez.
That's nothing new. You're always tired.
No, I'm up and raring to go.
You know, I always joke with my friends out here, people I know out here, whenever the subject of yourself might come up in a discussion, sometimes I'll toss out, you love sleep so much. And you know the joke. You know it's coming.
Go ahead.
If your wife came up to you and said, oh, honey, you know what? Let's have sex right now. You'd say, oh, that's great. But do you mind if I take a nap first?
I might say, hey, why not do both?
You're the only person I know who's actually gone on the record and said, if you could sleep 12 hours a day, you would.
I would. You know, I never get anywhere near that.
Of course not.
I mean, at most, I'm hitting 5. But I'm always thinking about it, though.
Most normal men think about sex every, what is it, 7 seconds? You think about sleep. Yes. Oh, pillow. Ooh, soft sheets.
Precious.
So what's up? What's been cooking?
Let's see. Tottered around on Pottermore for a while.
Yes. The new Harry Potter website.
Yes, it was actually entertaining. It's J.K. Rowling's way of letting people learn a little bit more about the series of books. So it's kind of like rehashing all of the books. And she's only released content for Sorcerer's Stone so far. Of course, they call it Philosopher's Stone.
That's the first book, right?
Yeah.
You got to remember, I am completely ignorant of almost all things Harry Potter.
Yes, I understand. And so what you do is you basically get to go through a Cliff Notes version of the story, and there's like nice little graphics in the background. And then there's things you can click on to go and see some personal notes or videos from J.K. Rowling to learn about what she was thinking about this at the time. And there was some cool stuff in there. Like, for example, I didn't know that all the secondary characters, she had plot lines developed for all of them, just so she would know where everybody, and even some of the tertiary characters.
Wow.
She has full plot lines developed for all of them. They just didn't make it into the main books because, well, they were long enough as it was.
Yeah, right. Sure. And I knew exactly where I would place the spoon in the dining hall.
And they have some cool stuff, like you get to get sorted into a house by putting on the sorting hat and it asks you a series of questions and then puts you into one of the four houses. And then there's...
I would get the outhouse.
Slytherin, I'm sure.
Well.
That's one of the four houses, by the way.
Yes, I know that much. I've seen one or two of the movies.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you saw at least the first one, but I'm sure it's been years.
Oh, yeah, it has.
And then you get to practice casting spells, and you get to challenge other people casting these spells, and you get to make potions. And there's a lot of little fun stuff in there.
Calm down. Calm down already. Jeez.
So it was pretty cool.
Getting all excited, getting all worked up.
I hung out with my son yesterday. And
very good.
He actually took me to Myopic Books, which is over in Bucktown.
Okay, yeah.
And it's like
I was going to say, that sounds really familiar from when I lived in Chicago.
Yeah, I think they've been around for a long time. And they're one of these used bookstores that have every inch of it, including the basement and the attic, are packed with books.
Yeah.
It's one of those places where you go and you could expect to find a copy of the Necronomicon in human skin.
Yeah, right. All buried away, hidden in the back behind a locked door.
Exactly. So that was pretty cool. And then I ended up seeing Cowboys versus Aliens last night.
Oh, you hadn't seen it?
No, I hadn't seen it. What did you think?
I thought it was all right.
I thought it was all right, too. Well, I like Harrison Ford a lot.
I don't know. I'm not going to knock Harrison Ford too much, but it seems like he's the same guy all the time now.
Well, he's getting up there, you know.
I know. He kind of strikes me as the character he plays now is sort of like the get off my lawn.
That would be the character I'm starting to play.
I actually started watching, well, I shouldn't say started. I watched all 5 seasons of it on Netflix, The Guild.
Did you?
Yes.
So what did you think of The Guild?
I could not get into it until the 5th season.
Jeez, it took you that long to get into it?
I watched the first season. And of course, all it is, it's about, what, an hour and 20 minutes?
Right.
Once they combine all the little separate episodes together. And I gotta say, since I'm not a big online multiplayer role-playing game kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
Granted, I got the references and everything else. It just wasn't really clicking, you know?
Right.
But then the 5th season, when they go to the convention, that I thought was funny. Not only with all the various different cameos that they had from people who are convention mainstays.
Right.
I was surprised they didn't have Lou Ferrigno in it, to be honest. That I could identify with. And I did find a lot of that a lot funnier because it branched out a bit more. The first 4 seasons, it's really all about the game.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah.
Well, as an old World of Warcraft player, I really appreciated that part.
I mean, it was good enough for me to stick with it. Finished watching the first episode, and I thought, what is the big deal about this show? Granted, Felicia Day, she is super hot.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Me and redheads, you know, come on. And she is supposed to be one of our geek icons in real life, just like Will Wheaton plays a lot of games, stuff like that.
Right.
I don't know. What did you think of it? As soon as I said I watched it, you were like, hey!
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I love the Guild. I think it's pretty good.
Very cool.
It's got a lot of references in there to stuff that only people who play a lot of MMORPGs would catch.
Right.
And so since I was a part of that crowd, I enjoyed it much more.
I completely understand.
Yep.
In the 5th season, I especially like the steampunk characters. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yes. Yes. I did really like the 5th season. They did a really good job there.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty cool. The other thing is I did receive a package from Spartan Games containing a bunch of Dystopian Wars miniatures.
Uh-huh.
And the rules, all I have to say is, wow.
Really?
Yes. These minis are awesome. Now, I only got the naval forces for the game because the way the game is set up, it's air, land, and sea. And you can actually have these units all fighting together on one battlefield. So you could have part of it is, you know, the coastline and the ocean and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's a steampunkish setting and just, wow, just fantastic miniatures. They're mainly resin, some metal, and just the detail to them, just fantastic. And the pricing of them is very, very reasonable for what you get.
Huh.
It was funny because I was looking and, you know, the ships are broken down and because I got their kind of a bundle that they've got.
Yeah.
And each of the different factions, because you have Britannia and the Prussians and the Covenant of Antarctica and the Federated States of America. And they're all unique. They have a completely different look. The Rising Sun, which is obviously Japan, their units look really wild. The land units are very, very cool, too. I've seen photos. I haven't seen them up close. In each of the packs, you get a dreadnought for that side. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, gosh, back in the day when we were just getting into naval miniatures, you would have to spend $30-$40 for a ship that size.
Right.
Whereas, for an example, for right around, $48 for one of their battle groups, as they call them, you'll get one of their battleships or dreadnoughts or whatever they want to consider it. You get 3 cruisers, you get 9 frigates, you get a couple of bombers or big airplanes, you get 10 tokens that represent the little planes.
Uh-huh.
And they're very, very cool. And then 2 of the naval groups actually come with booklets inside because they were fairly new factions to be added to the game. So the Republic of France has a 40-page booklet that talks about that faction and all the different units. And the other one is the Covenant of Antarctica, all of their units. Really, really cool looking stuff. I'm like jonesing to start painting these up. I'm still finishing up my dust tactics.
Uh-huh.
But very, very nice. People should check it out. And I will definitely have a review of Dystopian Wars coming up, probably either the next show or the show after that.
Oh, nice. So you said it was Spartan Games, right?
Spartan Games, yes. They're out of the UK. It's pretty nice. They'll do free shipping on orders over £100, which is $160 US with the exchange rate.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't believe how fast I got this stuff.
Yeah?
I placed the order, I want to say like the 23rd, and got it on the 27th.
Really?
And
pretty good,
was,
actually.
Yeah, and that was coming from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do notice that on their website, they do state that shipping could take them some time to process the order, but they processed it right away.
Very cool.
You have to say about Dystopian Wars that I wasn't a big fan of is the U.S. forces. The Confederates won the Civil War.
Okay.
So that's why it's the Federated States of America.
Wouldn't it be the Confederated States of America?
Yeah, I'm just telling you what the rules are, man. Okay. I'm just giving you the setting because they did get the backing from Britannia. Okay. I don't know, man. When they came up with this whole idea for the different factions, did they kind of think to themselves, you know, that whole Confederacy, that was all about slavery. Regardless of whatever anybody wants to say about states' rights, the Civil War boiled down to freeing the slaves or not freeing the slaves. In reality, that's what it boiled down to.
Right.
And Great Britain, no matter what they told to the Confederate's emissaries,
right.
They
would never.
You're
exactly right.
Kind of was a little, I don't know, but still very, very cool. Looks like an excellent system. I'm really looking forward to digging into it. But outside of that, that's about all that's new for me.
Okay. Well, are we ready for some news?
I think so.
Good evening, Mr. Mrs. North and South America, all the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France. Flash.
Coming soon from Stronghold Games is the 30th anniversary edition of Survive, Escape from Atlantis. This is a true classic, and now brought back by Stronghold Games with completely upgraded components, and now in a 30th anniversary edition. In Survive, you try to lead your explorers from the sinking central island of Atlantis to the safety of one of your four islands nearby. Your explorers can get there quickly by boat, if they can get to one, or more slowly by swimming. But it will be a perilous journey as they must avoid sea serpents, whales, and sharks. When the volcano on Atlantis explodes, the game is over. The player with the most explorer points wins. And now the 30th anniversary edition includes new artwork all over the box, and on the tiles, and on the board. So basically, new artwork.
I got
throughout.
That new artwork all over the box, man. It's just like, I spilt
just
it on
the
there.
Top of the box.
I got it all over the box.
They have new high-quality plastic peoples, or meeples as we call them, with brightly colored stamped numbers on the bottom. Part of the problem they had in the first time they released it is they were wooden, and they had these numbers stamped, like almost etched into the bottom.
I was going to say, a little bit of a problem reading them, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And I guess a lot of people did. So now they have the plastic ones, and the numbers just stamped into the bottom, and it's white, so it's a lot easier to read.
Okay.
They also have a new box tray for better storage of the components. Woo! And they remove the optional components, which was the dolphins and the dive dice, to keep the cost down for this new edition, because they lowered the actual cost by $10 the new edition. I thought that was pretty cool.
And I know you did enjoy the Stronghold Games version of it that came out last year.
I did. That was the first time I ever played Survive, and I really liked it. We had a lot of fun playing it.
Asmodee Editions is releasing a horror party game.
Ooh.
It's from Moonster Games, and it's called Texas Zombies, and it should be in stores in just a few days. It's a game for 3 to 6 players, and it pits players against an invasion of zombies on a military base in Texas. Oh, the brains are sweet. They're such a treat. Deep in the heart of Texas. Texas Zombies is a party game that combines an atmosphere of horror movies and the terror of zombie movies. Aren't they both kind of the same horror movies, zombie movies? I don't know.
They have zombie comedies.
That's true. Well, there are. A group of students from the University of Texas decide to visit an old military base, but are surprised by how they're greeted. They come face to face with zombies and a Mexican drug cartel. As if zombies weren't bad enough. To get out of the terrifying situation, they must use the tools they have at their disposal, such as a cucumber, a knife, and a deck of cards.
A cucumber?
Yes. That's what it says. A cucumber.
Damn
a
it.
Knife,
where's my cucumber?
Deck of cards.
The zombies are coming.
I took the cucumber and I plunged it through his eye socket, man. And then I took my deck of cards and I sawed his head off.
Everybody knows when you drop a deck of cards on the floor, a zombie has to lean over and start picking them up.
And they'll get one of those paper cuts and that'll be the end. I don't know. Sounds kind of bizarre, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
So that should be out in stores this week. Texas Zombies.
Nice. Now available at fine retailers everywhere is Banditos, a game for 2 to 6 hombres. In 1982, Mexico's economy collapsed, and the government's response was to centralize the banks and devalue the peso.
Because we know before that point, the peso was so valuable.
It was. That'll be 1 billion pesos.
For the chiclet.
In the game world of Banditos, the Mexican people responded poorly to these changes. Well, hey. Resulting in a decrease of effective security and an increase in creative accounting at the new Banco de Mexico. Once some of the alternatively principled people in the land of opportunity heard about this, they looked south of the border for their ventures. Oh, I wanted to get to the part where you go, hey! You will play one of several American characters making runs into Mexico to pull bank heists. You will need to acquire vehicles, weapons, seed money, and maybe even some inside information to make it all happen. The first player to get his character home with the equivalent of $1 million wins. Players can acquire cards, vehicles, etc. by drawing them each turn, or by buying them from other players, or by stealing them from the discard pile. Doing anything deemed illegal, however, will bring heat to your character. Or your vehicle, or Mexican cities, if you pull a heist. It's up to you as a player to manage your risk and decide how desperate you are to acquire what you need versus how much heat you currently have. If you have the guts to try a risky heist, it'll either pay off or you'll land in a Mexican jail and have to play catch-up. Banditos has an MSRP of $39.95.
I'm a little confused here.
Don't ask me too many questions because that's about all I know.
I don't get it, because if the peso has completely been devalued, why are people from the U.S. going down there to steal them?
They're stealing U.S. dollars.
Ah,
the first
thank you.
Player to get 1 million U.S. dollars.
You know, it said the equivalent. Didn't you say the equivalent of $1 million?
How many pesos would that take, really?
Oh my gosh, that's what I'm thinking. Right, the game lasts 70 years.
I don't know. I hadn't even heard of the game before I
Me either,
noticed
right?
it, yeah.
Fantasy Flight Games is bringing Descent Journeys in the Dark and the Conversion Kit this summer. The new edition is going to introduce campaign play, updated rules, new heroes, and new monsters. You'll also find 48 map tiles and nearly 150 tokens inside the box. Descent Journeys in the Dark, second edition, is a board game in which one player takes on the role of the treacherous overlord. I guess that would be me. And up to 4 other players take on the roles of courageous heroes. Featuring double-sided modular board pieces, countless hero and skill combinations, and an immersive story-driven campaign, Descent Journeys in the Dark, second edition, transports heroes to a vibrant fantasy realm where they must stand together against an ancient evil. Once again, me. This updated version of the classic board
game.
You're
not that old, man.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, I guess they have to stand together against the middle-aged evil. This updated version of the classic board game of Dungeon Delving Adventure features a host of enhancements, including new heroes and monsters, streamlined rules, class-based hero system, campaign play, and much more. You'll be able to pick up the second edition and the conversion kit for people who own the first edition this summer.
Actually, I'm kind of looking forward to this one. I mean, I've played the first edition.
I never have. I've never played Descent.
And it's cool, but it's one of those games, kind of say like Arkham Horror, where they've released additional expansions, a lot of them over time.
Sure.
And so they learn more things and they add in new mechanics over time.
Right.
Now they're at the point where they're basically doing a reboot of the game and incorporating a lot of those mechanics that got put into all those expansions. Like the campaign rules. That was an expansion by itself.
Right.
And they're putting all those into the base game. So you'll be able to play with that right from the get-go, which is really kind of neat.
Hmm. I've heard good things about the original edition, so I'd like to check this one out.
Yeah, the kids love that one. Katie really liked playing Descent. She mentions it all the time.
Well, they're always asking her to run D&D, too.
That's true.
They like the fantasy themes.
They're into the fantasy.
That's right.
You know, speaking of Fantasy Flight games, they're in the middle of beta testing their Community Wizard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Community Wizard is a new feature on the FFG website that allows you to search for other players in your area interested in playing your favorite FFG game, or to find local retailers who carry the product you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there's gaming conventions, game clubs, and more. It's kind of like a Google.
I'm going to Google that real quickly.
It's kind of like Google Maps for FFG. Here's what FFG says about it. They're pleased to announce the open beta of the FFG Community Wizard. This powerful online tool was designed to help you find more people and places to play your favorite FFG games. Its comprehensive search function allows you to see all the local activity surrounding your favorite FFG games, placing you in touch with new people, venues, and events with which to play your favorite games. Complementing the Community Wizard's search capabilities is a full suite of online tools. Simply create a free FFG forum account, and you will be able to enjoy an interface that provides customized options depending on your account type. So you can be an organization, a retailer, a player, a convention, those kind of things. And it's tailored to who you are.
And how you want to use it.
Exactly. They have convenient event management tools. Players can propose events through their favorite local retailers, and retailers can approve them with a click of a mouse. Manage the guest list, send mass messages to guests, and more. They have a robust private messaging system, including convenient color coding and optional email forwarding. When used in conjunction with the Community Wizard's search capabilities, this helpful communication system lets you quickly connect to other players, retailers, and event organizers that your searches locate. Plus, you get enhanced control over your collection of games. You list games that you own, as well as those that you're currently playing or interested in playing. Like-minded local players can then use the Community Wizard to inform you of upcoming games and events. I'm really looking forward to that. There's not a lot of people in the beta test right now. I felt really lonely because I went in there, I signed in and tried it out, you know?
I'm so lonely!
So you basically select the game. So I picked like Arkham Horror. And
all these posts were like, I don't play that crap.
No, it was a map, right? So First you can do a 6-mile radius search. So I click that and it just shows me, you know, it shows the whole world. It's just me, Google Maps, right? So, Okay, well, let's expand it to 60 miles. And it expands and it's, you know, the screen's a little bigger and there's just me. So, okay. So I expand it to 600 miles and it shows the entire Earth and it's just this little dot that's me. I'm like, no!
Just so you know, the Earth is a little bigger than 600 miles.
I understand, but it didn't go higher than 600 miles. But it does show the entire Earth on the picture, you know?
Right, sure, yeah.
It's just me. You fools! You blew it up!
Well, we're so glad we sold that one copy of Arkham Horror to Elliot Miller.
Yes, it's still in beta test, so they're working out bugs and things like that.
Oh, sure, of course. Earlier this week at the Mensa Mind Games in Herndon, Virginia, 300 judges played over a period of 2 days to choose 5 games among 68 as 2012 Mensa Select winners. Those games are IOTA, a card game in which you play and score cards. Each of the 3 attributes for all cards in a line must either be all the same or all different. Snake Oil, party game of making up crazy products and convincing people to buy them. Mind Shift, mine, not mind. Navigate your jewel through the maze mine or rearrange the mine. Coercio, or Coercio, I don't know, in which the players attempt to surround each other's pieces to capture them and also the board shrinks as the game is played. Tetris Link, drop Tetris pieces into the tower slot. Linking pieces with the same color earns points, but leaving gaps earns a penalty. Those sound just awe-inspiring.
What are you talking about? No rowboat?
Rowboat wasn't eligible. This is 2012.
Oh, man.
Now, if there had been a rowboat 2, the high tide, maybe. Now, I know the Mensa Award isn't a big deal for most game companies and for most gamers either, most real, true gamers. But I do have to point out, at least it is an award that means something. There's a lot of these awards out there for family games. You know, I'm not going to go to Consim World Expo and say, hey, anybody want to play Snake Oil? Come on. I mean, let's get real. But at least the judges do play these games. It isn't just simply, oh, here's my check for $300 or whatever. And now I've got the Dr. Award of Great Gamesmanship or whatever.
Why do I picture a bunch of old guys with beards and white robes on? I don't know.
Yeah. It's the Supreme Court. They all get together and they game. And my understanding, it's 36 hours of gaming. So they get 8 hours of sleep and a couple hours for like meal breaks. And the rest of the time, they are playing these games.
Wow.
I understand they don't get to play every game to completion because they learn the game and play it and then have to judge it. But at least it's an award based on people playing. And I'd say it's good for just your casual gamer, people who are into family games and such.
Very cool. I like Mensa. Someday yeah. I'll be a member.
Yeah, you keep thinking that.
Asmodee Games announced the first expansion to Timeline, called Timeline Discoveries. Timeline is a card game played using 109 cards, and each card depicts an invention on both sides, as well as the year in which that invention was made, but only on one side. Players take turns placing the cards in a row on the table, and each card must be placed in the correct order on the timeline. The first expansion to Timeline is called Discoveries, and it lets you show off your knowledge of the year specific things were discovered. Remember the discovery of wood or the discovery of monkeys? Well, you won't find those in the game, but you'll find many others. And Timeline Discoveries is scheduled for a July 2012 release. If you haven't tried Timeline yet, the original game is back in stock at your favorite retailer right now with the low MSRP of $14.99.
And it comes in a smashingly cool-looking tin.
It does.
If you're planning on buying Ogre, the designer's edition from Steve Jackson Games, but want to buy it through your friendly local game store, SJG has an option for you. They have a pre-order form that you can fill in your information, then take it to your local game store to place your order. The pre-orders are going to be accepted through May 23rd only, so you want to get your order in as soon as possible. Only a limited number of Ogre Designer's Edition games are going to be available this way. I'm not sure if you have to pay for it up front, though. I believe you probably do. So in all honesty, you might have a better option just going on to Kickstarter and placing your support there. We already know it's being made.
Yeah. What's the big deal about the Designer's Edition? I mean, I know it's been a long, long time that Ogre's been published.
Have you not seen it?
No. How often did I play Ogre?
No, I'm saying you haven't seen the Designer Edition?
No.
It's huge. It's massive.
It's real size?
Yes. check out the news piece on the website. There's been a few of them. One of them shows Steve Jackson holding the box. The box is massive.
Really?
In fact, they're trying to figure out how are they going to do overseas because they want to open up the Kickstarter project because there's still time left.
Uh-huh.
And it's at $280,000.
Yeah, I know. It's hugely funded.
Oh, yeah. The box itself is 14 pounds. And jeez, the size of it, yeah, it's a lot of cardboard because the ogres are these three-dimensional cardboard, which I wasn't real thrilled with.
Yeah, why didn't they just make
plastic minis plastic or something? One, yeah. Yeah, I know. But still, it's just going to be huge. Honestly, it was Steve Jackson's first game. I'm pretty excited to see what it looks like. And to be honest, I'm more excited just to see Steve Jackson breaking out of just the same stuff that they normally do.
I agree. 100%.
I'm not harping. I'm just saying I'm glad to see.
Wait, where's Munchkin Ogre?
This happened. Shut up. Enough. Anyway, for those who are expecting to pick up Ogre Designer's Edition at their local game stores when it comes out, it is scheduled to ship in November. So you don't want to miss out on this limited print run of the classic game.
Excellent. Sounds good. Did you know that Days of Wonder is currently running a contest and the winner will receive an Apple iPad?
No, I did not know this.
Well, the Days of Wonder homepage includes a ticker that shows just how many online games have been played through Days of Wonder Online, and they're getting close to reaching their 30 millionth Days of Wonder online game.
Wow.
30 million is a big number, and they think it sounds like a great excuse to hold a contest and give away one of Apple's new iPads. So that's the prize Days of Wonder will hand out to the winner of the 30 millionth online game. Plus, they'll throw in copies of both Ticket to Ride for iPad and Small World for iPad. And each of the other players in that game will receive a copy of the Days of Wonder board game of their choice. Every registered member of Days of Wonder Online is eligible, and while it will take some luck as well as skill, the only thing you need to do is play any of your favorite Days of Wonder Online games against other live players on the network. These include the online versions of Ticket to Ride, Memoir 44, Gang of Four, Fist of Dragonstones, or Queen's Necklace. Your game can only include live players, no bots, and your game must be completed. The lucky winners will be announced on the Days of Wonder news blog within 7 days after the 30 millionth game is completed. And I recommend you see the Days of Wonder website for complete rules. From my calculations, I'm guessing maybe 10, 11 days left till they hit it.
So. Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new mecha game coming from Toy Vault, and it's Abaddon, and it should be in stores this week. The game's designed by Richard Borg and includes 32 miniatures, 18 terrain feature pieces, 15 scenarios, a deck of 100 cards, rules, and special dice. The suggested manufactured retail price is $79.99. An all-star lineup of gaming aces will soon unleash an exhilarating board game of astronomical entertainment. Man, that's putting a heavy burden on this
astronomical
game.
Astronomical entertainment, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Ooh. Toy Vault, Inc., legendary game designer Richard Borg, he of Memoir 44 and Battle Cry fame, just to name a few, and superstar artist Chris Quillams, 2011 Golden Geek Award winner for Best Board Game Artwork / Presentation, are ready to take you on a thrill-a-minute conquest through the perilous depths of the cosmos in Abaddon. In the remote future, mankind has taken a multi-galactic leap through space. Life as we know it struggles to endure in the region known as the Abaddon. Once the home of a mysterious non-human civilization, the Abaddon is now a post-apocalyptic wasteland bearing one immeasurably prized resource, Feronium power crystals. The near infinite energy contained within the crystals is greatly coveted and viciously warred over by two groups of humans, the satellite city-states and the Commonwealth Alliance. Using Links, gigantic biomech suits made via alien technology from modified military vehicles, the rivaling factions fight a bitter battle for territorial control of the Abaddon. You can join the adventures with Abaddon upon its official release on April 30th, which is actually the day this show comes out.
That's true. So run out right now.
Go get it. It's in the store.
You know, Feronium was my character name on World of Warcraft.
That was my radio name in Saskatchewan.
Catan Jr. has been released and is now available from Mayfair Games. Catan Jr. introduces a modified playing style of the classic game, giving younger players the opportunity to experience the world of Catan. It's designed for players as young as 5 and is a perfect introduction to the Catan series of games for kids and families. Catan Jr. takes place on a ring of islands where 2 to 4 players build hideouts and the mysterious Spooky Island. You know, that's where Scooby-Doo hung out a lot.
Come on, bring it on. Bring on the parrot. Come on, tell us about the parrot.
There's a parrot? I don't know. That's where the ghost captain lives.
No, there's a parrot in the game. Come on.
All right, wait, I'm getting there. Each island generates a specific resource, wood, goats, rum, or swords, and players can acquire gold. Each player starts with 2 pirate hideouts and then builds ships in order to expand their network. The more hideouts you build, the more resources you may receive. You use your resources to build ships, hideouts, or to get help from Coco the Parrot.
There we go. I knew it was coming.
Just watch out for the dreaded ghost captain. Be the first player to control 7 pirate hideouts and you win the game. Actually, I said it was for 2 to 4 players. It's actually from 3 to 4 players. Ages 6 and up.
Yeah, okay.
Hey, that was a mistake on their part, not mine.
Aha, right? Yes.
And has an MSRP of $35. You can buy it right now at your favorite gaming retailer.
Right now. So as you're scrambling to go get Abaddon.
Right. You got another order to place.
You can go snag Catan Jr. for the kiddies.
I think Aaliyah would really like it, my youngest daughter.
Mm-hmm. I already said before, it's probably the only Catan I'd be able to win. So. Flatlight Games is coming out with a new board game. The only problem is they have no idea what they want to call it. So they're asking for your suggestions.
Mine?
Anybody's.
Oh.
The game's going to release at Essen 2012. And it's designed by Felipe Kayerts, who did Vinci, Evo, Small World, Olympos, In the game, players program two robots to harvest gems and bring them back to their bases. Robots don't fight. Well, there's the entertainment value right there. But they can push each other and, of course, steal gems. Get out of my way. Ooh, take that. However, the game doesn't have a name yet. They have a few ideas, but they figure that most of the public have a lot of ideas too, so they're looking for your help. It's not a contest, but they're going to find a nice way to thank the best entries. If you want to go to the Flatlined Games website and give them a great name for this game, let them know.
I got one already. Gembot Bumpin'. There you go. I won't even charge them for that.
How about Gembot Pushers?
You always got to turn everything dirty somehow.
All they can do is push each other. How about Snoreville Euro Crap?
I don't know if they would go with that one, though. I'm not really sure. Chaosium has released free Call of Cthulhu Quick Start Rules.
Free!
Free! I'm sure if you've listened to a few of our podcasts, you've heard Jeff and I talk about playing Call of Cthulhu, the role-playing game, a few times. Maybe.
A few.
Well, if you've ever been interested in trying a horror RPG, here is... Now, that's horror. Here is your chance to dip your toes in...
Why do you
in.
Have to make everything dirty?
I didn't say nothing, man. Without costing a nickel. Chaosium has released a PDF of quick start rules to the Call of Cthulhu RPG, and they're aiming at not only those who have never played CFC, but players who don't even know what an RPG is.
How can anyone these days not know what a role-playing game is?
I guess it is possible. I don't know. The Chaosium website says the CFC Quick Start Rules is a booklet that collects the essential rules for Call of Cthulhu and presents them in abbreviated form. The book comprises a basic role-playing system, which, for the uninitiated, is a framework of rules. Now, come on, this is a definition of a role-playing game there.
I'm hanging in here. I just chuckled.
Aimed at allowing players to enact a sort of improvisational radio theater, only without microphones, and with dice determining whether the characters succeed or fail in what they attempt to do. Now, in role-playing games, Jeff, let me just tell you about this. Yes. One player takes on the role of the Game Master, or Keeper, as we say in Call of Cthulhu, while the other players assume the roles of the player characters, or PCs, in the game. The Game Master also acts out the roles of characters who aren't being guided by players, and these are called NPCs, you see, for non-player characters.
Ah, gotcha. Mm-hmm. I follow.
Got me. Okay. From its origin, Call of Cthulhu was designed to be intuitive and easy to play. Character attributes follow a 3d6 curve, and the other Call of Cthulhu mechanics are even simpler. Virtually all rolls determining success or failure of a task are determined via the roll of percentile dice. This means that there's less fiddling with dice of different types, and the concept of a percentile chance of success is extremely easy for beginners and experienced players to grasp. You can use this booklet to play Call of Cthulhu immediately. It includes game rules, pre-generated characters, and a classic adventure.
I bet you the adventure is that house one with the ghosts. The spirit, I forget what they call the adventure.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yes. Control that dagger.
You're probably right. I haven't looked at it.
Yep. I can't remember the name of it, but it has been in every edition of Call of Cthulhu since the beginning.
Dawn of time.
Yes.
And you can download it right now for free at the Chaosium website or on RPG Now as a watermarked PDF. It's
okay.
Kind of cool.
I'm going to throw something out here real quickly. Two things. Number one, they comment that if you're not familiar with what a role-playing game is, think of it as a radio drama. I guarantee you more people know what a role-playing game is than would know what radio drama would be.
Yeah, radio drama has gone the way of the dodo in the past years.
Well, in the U.S. at least.
Yeah.
In Europe, the BBC is still huge on radio drama.
On the BBC.
Which I love. I love listening. Well, I guess I shouldn't say I'm able to listen to the BBC. But anyway. I use my satellite receiver. Yeah.
My sonic screwdriver.
But if you remember, I shared with you that BBC version of At the Mountains of Madness.
Yes, which was excellent.
That's just an example of the stuff that the BBC still does.
I did like their Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series they did, too.
Well, that's pretty old. That's
yes,
going back a while.
Well, I'm old.
So that was the first thing. Second thing is... Please, enough with the what is a role-playing game. It cracks me up whenever I get a role-playing game rule book, a core book. There's always 2-3 pages devoted to what is a role-playing game. come on, guys, let's get real here. Everybody knows what a role-playing game is. So if you and I ever decide that we're going to create our own role-playing game, our core book, we're going to have what is an RPG or what is a role-playing game? And it's simply going to say the book you have in your hand. Enough said.
Exactly. Well, you know, I was disturbed when I found out that there were people who didn't know that Titanic, the movie, was based on a real catastrophe that happened. I'm just wondering what kind of education they have going on.
We are not even going to delve into that because we could spend an entire show talking about.
Oh, come on. You don't want to talk about the national public school system right now on this show about gaming?
It's not even the public school system. Don't let the private school kids off the hook because they're no great shakes either.
All righty then.
All right. Moving right along. Our final bits of news are about us, which I like to kind of finish up our news with the latest.
I love hearing about us.
Oh, yeah. I know. Mr. Ego. Just want to point out that because we are now starting to enter into convention season, the scheduling of the show might be a little wonky for the next few months, simply because of the weekends that the conventions fall into. I know there's four conventions I'm currently scheduled to attend. Elliot's got three or four he's got on his books. You know, of course, Origins and Gen Con we're going to be at together.
Right.
We will do our best to try to get some raw coverage out there like we did with Gen Con last year.
Right. Yes.
Soon afterwards. But if you find that our scheduled Monday show isn't up, don't be shocked. We'll get it up as soon as possible. Plus, with the upcoming conventions, we are going to have tons and tons of extras with different interviews with various different people in the industry. So that'll be cool, too.
Yep.
Other item I wanted to mention is we finished up our poll on what people thought of the new look and new content for the Gaming Gang website. It was overwhelmingly positive. Over 78% of voters said they either liked it or thought it was great.
That's pretty good percentage, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think so too. It was less than 10% didn't like it. And for the six people who voted that they hate the new website, there's plenty other websites out there. Go knock yourself out.
No, six people, come back.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Let's try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
The first game I'm going to be reviewing is Flat Acting from Eye Level Entertainment. It came out in 2009, and it's for 2 to 5 players ages 8 and up. It takes about a half hour to 45 minutes to play it. Flat Acting from Eye Level Entertainment is a game in which you are challenged to score the most points by moving the actors from your movie genre into the most advantageous positions on the different movie sets depicted on the game boards. Each set is worth a certain number of points, and if you have the most actor points on that set, you win the score for the whole set at the end of the game. The player with the most points at the end of the game is the winner. The game comes with 4 square boards of nice quality. They're glossy, and each one represents a certain genre. There are 4 genres in the game: romance, scary, detective, or western. And there is a bonus genre which represents the movie crew, which really isn't a genre, but still, and can be used as a 5th player, or simply used to block other players during a 2-4 player game. There's 50 character tokens with plastic stands representing 10 from each genre. They're thick, and they have cartoonish representations of different characters from the genres, like a horse for the western, a vampire for the scary genre, and so on. Each character has a point value listed on it. The bulk of the cards are called casting cards, and each displays 2 characters from a certain genre along with a point value. When drawn, that will be used to select a character to move to a set on the boards where there's room. The first time you draw a card that cannot be placed because of movement restrictions, then the game is over and the points are totaled up. There's additional cards called rewrite cards that a player can hang on to, allowing them to take special actions during their turn, like swapping 2 characters, locking a set with a lock token so that the characters there cannot be moved, bonus points, and removing an actor from the board. There's a card...
You're fired! I want you off my set!
Exactly.
Lindsay Lohan, I have had enough of you!
Who will be playing Liz Taylor soon. in a Lifetime movie, I think.
I saw she was just at the press correspondence dinner in Washington.
Okay, she was? I didn't know.
Yeah, I saw her photo there. I have nothing against Lindsay Lohan. I just, she's an easy mark, that's all. I'm not one of these people who are like, oh man, I hope she's dead by the time she's 30, like some of these idiots out there.
Right. I don't know. She was just on Filmed with the Glee cast, and she was over 3 hours late to the set, and they had to go pick her up. You know, whatever.
Yeah. You and Glee, I swear. Man. Back to the review.
Yes, back to the review. There is a card representing each genre, which the players will keep in front of them to indicate which genre that they have. And finally, there's a few wild cards from each one that allows you to place or move any actor from that genre on the boards. At the start of the game, each player selects a board and places it on the table. The boards have to be lined up and connected so that the walls match up in a logical fashion. Then each player draws a genre card and places it in front of them. All of the characters are placed off to the side of the board, waiting to be cast in a movie. The first player begins by drawing a card from the deck, and if it's one of the rewrite cards, they keep it face up on the table in front of them for later use, and they continue to draw cards until they get one of those casting cards. Then they can choose from either character that's shown on the casting card, and they must place one of those characters on one of the sets on the board, or move them from one set to another set. The choice is yours.
Mine?
Yes, yours. The one restriction is that you cannot place a character on a set if it will make the total point value of the characters on that set greater than the point value of the set itself, which is printed on the board. For example, if a set has a point value of 8, and there's already a character on that set with a point value of 5, you can only place a character there with a point value of 3 or less. Otherwise, you'll exceed the 8 maximum that that set can hold.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after you resolve the casting card, you can play as many rewrite cards as you want. Otherwise, play passes to the next player, who draws a casting card and continues until a card is drawn that cannot be played. If you run out of cards, you simply shuffle the discards and kept going. So the basic strategy of the game is to get the characters from your genre onto sets so that your points on that set are higher than any other player's points. This way, you will score the whole point value of that set when the game ends. If you have two characters with a total point value of 5, and another player has a character with a total point value of 3 on that set, that is worth a total of 8 points, then at the end of the game, you would score all 8 points for that set. The one interesting twist is that if you're tied for the highest amount with another player, then they cancel each other out, and any other player left on that set gets the full point value. The fun part of the game is that when you place a character on a set, you have to come up with some logical reason for that character to be on that particular set. You announce this to the other players when you place the character. Suddenly, a skeleton burst into the room, startling the cleaning lady. Oh my god. Luckily, the detective brought along a picnic basket, as he knew it would be a long stakeout. These are both valid reasons. This is what adds the drama, or flat acting, to the game. And it is fun. If a player forgets to do this, another player can yell, "Cut!" and give a critic token to the offending player. For each thumbs down on the critic token, the player loses that many points at the end of the game. Flat acting had its fun moments, mostly during the added drama part of the game. However, I do have a few criticisms. First of all, I didn't like that you never knew when the game was going to end. It can end at any time once most of the characters are on the board. It can end suddenly before you're ready, or drag on once the players get the idea of the best strategies for placing their characters. I prefer having an idea of when the end is coming, although some gamers may like this aspect. Secondly, if you're unlucky, the bulk of your character cards may get shuffled to the bottom of the deck. So while everyone else is getting the prime spots on the board, you're waiting to see if any of your characters will actually get played. I had one game end where less than half of my characters were on the board. And thirdly is analysis paralysis. The play can slow down while a player looks over the whole board trying to find out the best place to put the character that they just drew, and it can make the game feel long and drawn out. Finally, the game is best suited for 4 players. 5 is okay too, but with 3 players, you have 2 genres that are non-player genres that are used primarily for blocking, and that can get tiresome. 2-player games are even worse, as there would be 3 blocking genres. Overall, it isn't a bad game. It's an okay game, best suited for family play. There are some fun moments, but there are also times when you can get really annoyed by the luck of the cards. That is Flat Acting by Eye Level Entertainment.
Okay. There you have it.
There you have it.
Not much else you can say about that.
No, I think I covered it all pretty well.
Well, my first review is Levy and Mass from Victory Point Games. And before we get into the review, I did want to just make mention that this is the last show that is sponsored by Victory Point Games. So we did want to take a moment to personally thank Alan Emmerich for being a huge supporter of the Gaming Gang. This is episode 40. I want to say, gosh, what is it, about 36 episodes? VPG is sponsored for us. So,
yes, and they are great.
You know, yeah. And they're going to continue advertising with us on the website. It's just they're not going to sponsor the podcast any longer because Elliot made them mad. But no,
that is not true.
Teasing. No, we want to actually try to open it up to bring in some other sponsors and so forth. So anyway, moving right along. Levy and Mass is designed by John Welsh. It came out in 2010. It's a solo game, and it is part of the States of Siege line. You can play it in about 35 minutes, and it's suggested for ages 12 and up. Levy and Mass was the fifth game in the VPG States of Siege series. And what it does is it puts you in control of the fate of France during the revolution as you try to move through the revolution and keep the enemies of France at bay. As with all things VPG, Levy and Mass comes in a Ziploc bag, which includes all the counters, the rules, cards, and a map of France. Also comes with a little itty bitty D6 for you to play. As with all these States of Siege series, you'll notice that there's different tracks, which all lead to a central point. If you've played any of the States of Siege games in the past, you'll know exactly what you're getting into. The rules are pretty much straightforward, and flow is governed by the event cards. Your role is as the protector of France, and you have various enemies who are working against it from without and within. You have to protect Paris from the invading armies, manage unrest in the capital, raise armies of your own, and promote the republic politically while trying to keep despotism and the monarchy down. The game's broken up into three phases, so you have three different decks of cards. One is blue, one is white, and one is red, and they represent different periods of time through the revolution.
Okay.
The blue deck is the period of the beginning of the revolution up and including the execution of King Louis.
No!
Let them eat cake! Yes, I know that was Marie Antoinette, but anyway. The white deck is the era of the Reign of Terror, and the red deck represents the rise of the Republic. Every turn, you're going to draw the top card of the deck that's in play, and in order, you'll resolve military, political, and social aspects of the card. As with pretty much all the cards from Victory Point Games, there's some flavor text at the bottom as well that gives some historical context to the card itself. The military part of the card indicates what armies are moving where, if any, and also gives additional die modifiers versus specific armies if you attack the army that turn. All the armies start further away down the track and move on toward Paris. What you're doing is attacking those armies to continue to push them back. Mm-hmm. Elliot knows this one. You know, like I said, anyone who's played any of the States of Siege knows all about it.
Yep.
With the political aspect of the card, you're going to move one or more of your tokens on the political track. What you want to do is you want the Republic moving to the right towards a four, and despotism and monarchy, you want to move toward the left so they become negatives. If the Republic is the highest valued token on the track, you get a +1 modifier to your military actions. But if the monarchy is ahead, you'll have a -1. The social aspect of the card is going to let you know how many actions you have available to you in your turn. As with any States of Siege game, you never have enough actions to do what you need to get done.
Of course.
Obviously.
Uh-huh.
Now, granted, I have to point out this was one of the earlier States of Siege games, so there's a little less under the hood than some of their more recent States of Siege. Prime example is the Steve Carey designs like We Must Tell the Emperor or Malta Besieged. There's a lot going on with those. This one, not as much. You know the odds are stacked against you, but you don't feel like you're backed in the corner sometimes with some of the other States of Siege games. Now, granted, this isn't an easy game to win by any stretch of the imagination, because It's a States of Siege game.
Would you say it'd make a better introductory?
Oh, most definitely, yes. Mm-hmm. If I were introducing someone to the States of Siege line, I would probably point them in the direction of Levy and Mass, for an example.
Okay.
And as much as I love We Must Tell the Emperor, Multiple Siege, Dawn of the Zeds, I mean, I can't say enough about that game. If I were really looking to introduce somebody to VPG, I may not necessarily go with one of those titles. They're not a war gamer. There might be a little too much going on in those games. I think this would be a very, very good introduction for them.
Okay, cool.
The actions you can take are political, so you can improve the Republic or hinder the monarchy. And of course, you have to roll your die to make sure that you're able to improve or reduce. You also have the military. So this is when you're going to attack those armies that are moving on Paris. And every one of the armies has a number printed on it as far as its strength. You have to roll higher than that number to be able to push them back. Then you also have to use your actions to liberate. So you have two liberation armies that can come into play via the event cards. You can use them to help prevent foreign armies from advancing into Paris. And they also help you to score points at the end of the game.
Uh-huh.
Lastly, you restore order because Paris is always up in arms during the revolution. The game is pretty difficult to defeat, like all States of Siege games.
Yeah.
It can end in one of two ways. Either an enemy army occupies Paris, and at that point, like in most States of Siege games, it's an instant loss. How badly you're defeated depends on what deck you're in the midst of. Or you can have a triumph. Historically, the French Revolution, according to the game, was a minor victory for the French. All in all, Levy and Mass has a lot going for it. Of course, because there are the event cards and the first and last card of each deck is predetermined, there's a lot of scripting to it. But every game is going to be a bit different. There are some suggested scenarios in the rules. So, of course, you can play the cards in order so you can play out the revolution chronologically. Or you can even shuffle all the cards randomly, including the ones to start and end each deck. There's a lot of ebb and flow going on in the game as well. There's also an expansion kit that's available that adds some additional cards and some more threats to the Republic to make the game even more challenging in case you need that. It plays relatively quickly. You can get in a game in about 30, 40 minutes or so. So it's a nice way to just whip something out real quick when you feel like getting a quick game in, don't have anybody else that you can involve into a game. And even on a lunch break or at work, as long as, you know, you're not going to be made fun of by people you work with, you can bust it out. Also to point out, it's being reworked by GMT as part of a new compilation that I believe is coming out. I don't think it's out yet, which does have another John Welsh design in it that I know of. As a matter of fact, it might be all three of the games are John Welsh designs. I'm not positive. Off the top of my head, I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either. I remember us talking about that before, which looks pretty cool because it gives the deluxe treatment to the games.
Get the GMT treatment, which we love our GMT.
Yep. Very cool.
And I have to point out on a personal note, I am looking forward to ConSim World Expo this summer because I'll have another opportunity to sit down and chat with John Welsh. Really nice guy.
Very nice. What would you say your favorite States of Siege game is? Would it be Dawn of the Zeds?
It's a tough one. The reason being, sometimes I'm in a mood for something like really historical.
Yeah.
And other times I'm just kind of a fluff mood. No, well, I don't mean it like that. I'm not going to go fluff somebody.
Did you get that fluff film?
No, that's called snuff. Those I've done.
Right.
Fluffing I have not. But sometimes I'm in the mood for something more fantastical, I guess we would say.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think overall, if we just look at it game-wise, yeah, Dawn of the Zeds is probably my favorite, with We Must Tell the Emperor coming in right behind it. I still really love Nemo's War 2.
Yeah, I do too.
I really like that game. It's whatever mood strikes me. Although there's a lot of the different States of Siege games that I have that I'll just bust out from time to time. I usually have one or two of them in the glove compartment.
Go for emergencies, like you get a flat tire. Quick!
No, just before. I'll show them to people, stuff like that.
Cool.
Dawn of the Zeds is a deluxe one, so it doesn't fit in right. the glove compartment.
It has to go under the seat.
Yeah, right. Funny thing is, I actually usually have 4 or 5 games in my car.
Stashed around the car.
I do, really. One of them I keep in there is Carcassonne.
Really?
Yeah, because if I'm in the middle of a conversation with somebody, and a lot of times I'll be out with people that I know, and they want to talk about the website and what we do. They all think it's, oh, Monopoly and the Game of Life and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I can say, hey, well, I'll tell you what, I actually have one of the games that I use to introduce people to the hobby in my car. You want to check it out? And a lot of times they're like, yeah, yeah, you know what? Yeah, I'll, sure. Could you teach me how to play it? It's like Carcassonne. I can teach you in 5 or 10 minutes.
Not
I
bad. So that's your go-to
can't
gateway.
Can't teach you how to win. Yeah, it usually is. And then I'll say, oh, you know, there's other games out there you can play by yourself and blah, blah, blah. And then I'll grab one of the States of Siege games. Kind of odd, but yeah. And sometimes people go, nah, nah, yeah, you don't have to show me it. It's like, oh, yeah, that's fine.
Still, you're working as an ambassador of the hobby, which is cool.
I try. Yes.
I try. I try my best.
I do. I try to be the Tommy Lasorda gaming, hey, you know?
Except for the screaming and swearing, you know, you leave that out.
Exactly. And I'm not a huge fan of the Dodgers, although I love Vin Scully for some strange reason.
Well, my second review is going to be on Lock and Key from Cryptozoic Entertainment. It came out just recently, and it is for 3 to 6 players. Plays in about a half hour, and it's a card game. Lock and Key started as a graphic novel. Actually, there are 3, but I've only read the first one. Did you read all 3?
Actually, if we want to be sticklers about it, it started as a comic book, sir.
Well, I read it as a graphic novel.
Yes, I know. I'm just saying.
It's the story of the Key House, a mysterious New England mansion where some of the doors lead to transformations to the characters that go through them. It's of the horror genre, so I was, of course, drawn to it.
Mm-hmm. Because you're sick that way. You're sick. There's something wrong with you. There's something very, very wrong with you.
This is a card game, and the cards look great, as all of the artwork was done by Gabriel Rodriguez, the artist from the graphic novels. I especially like the key cards, as they are foil cards, and we all know that shiny is good. There's a shiny is good,
for,
Ben.
For women.
Hey, come on. Magic the Gathering, the foil cards, they weren't cool? Is that what you're telling me?
I don't remember foil cards when we were playing Magic.
Well, they did come along a little later. There's a lock token to keep track of which player gets to play first, and they threw in a cardboard stand-up of the key house just for the heck of it. The rules are short and fairly simple, with specific additional information about certain cards and lots of examples of play. The object of the game is to score the most points by the time the game over challenge card is revealed. There are 3 types of cards, and they come in 3 different colors, or suits, of black, which represents the shadow army, white, which represents personal and psychological problems, or blue, which represents otherworldly encounters. The challenge cards are the main cards that determine the points you score and the end of the game. At the start of the game, you shuffle the game over card into the bottom 6 cards of the challenge deck, so that you're never quite sure when the game will end. Each challenge is one of the 3 colors and has a numeric value on it. This number is the total the players must meet or beat with the strength cards to win the challenge. Once a challenge is defeated, the player who played the most points in strength cards wins the challenge card and places it into their score pile. The challenge cards also have a second place reward listed on them for the player who played the next highest point total. The winner also receives the lock token, which enables them to play their cards first on the next challenge. The strength cards are the largest deck of cards, and these make up the bulk of the player's hand. At the beginning of the game, each player receives 4 strength cards. These have point values on them, and they're played to overcome the challenges. The key cards are special cards that are either one-time use or reusable, depending on the key that you draw.
Mm-hmm.
Each one does some special action, like changing the color of a card you played, or drawing an extra card, etc. You pick a starting player randomly, and they're given the lock token. The top challenge card is flipped over, and each player has a choice of 3 actions. You can either play up to 3 strength cards face down and try to defeat the challenge, or pass and draw a new strength card. Or you can pass and draw a key card from the key deck. The lock player goes first, and then play proceeds clockwise from there. Once everyone has played their cards or passed, the played cards are flipped over. Before the challenge is resolved, all players have a chance to play a key card if they wish. Then, all points of the cards matching the color of the challenge is added up. If they're equal or higher than the challenge card, then the challenge is won. The player who played the most points in strength cards gets the challenge card and scores the points on it. The second highest points played gets the reward listed on the card. If players tie, the player turn order determines who wins and who gets second place. The winner of the challenge gets the lock token and will play first next round. If the challenge isn't defeated, the card goes to the bottom of the challenge deck and nobody scores any points.
Sounds pretty easy to play.
Yeah, that's just repeated until the game over card is flipped up. The players add up all of their points in their score pile, and the highest total wins. The challenges are not the only way to score points. There are certain cards and rewards that allow you to score the top one or two cards off the strength deck as points. There's also combo cards that give bonuses if you pull off playing one of the combos, and there are other special cards that are built into the strength deck. One of the interesting mechanics that adds some strategy to the game is the fact that you can play cards of any color when facing a challenge. So you can fool the other players into thinking that you're going all out, either forcing them to drop out of a challenge because they think they can't win, or making them go all out to win.
Ha! Bluff!
Mm-hmm. Because the strength cards are a really valuable resource, as the main way to get new ones is to pass on your turn. When you run out, you have no choice but to pass, and you can't pass too often because there really aren't that many rounds. Hand management plays as big a role as the luck of the draw does. And this is a pretty fun game. The games are short, and it makes a good filler or a game to play as, say, a gateway game. The kids liked it a lot, and although it seems like it is too simple to be fun, that isn't the case. It's actually pretty addictive. The art does get a PG-13 rating from me, so I'd advise against playing it with the young ones. But I really like this game, and I think it's a good time. Lock and Key from Cryptozoic Entertainment.
How about the theme? How well do you get the theme from the game?
You get as much out of it as you can from a card game. All the cards have little sayings on them, and they all have little actions that you can do that are thematic. You know, how much theme can you really build into a card game?
Yeah.
I did get the feel of the whole Lock and Key universe, mostly because of the characters and the entities that they come across. And, you know, it's got a little creepiness built into it. But the biggest theme adder is the little stand-up they give you that you put on the side.
The house?
Yeah, it's just a little 5-inch stand-up that you just set next to the board.
If I remember right, isn't the house located in Lovecraft, Massachusetts?
Is it Massachusetts or Maine?
For some reason, I thought it's Massachusetts, but I'm not sure.
I'm just thinking because it's Joe Hill.
Well, it's Stephen King, it would be. It's in Castle Rock. You know, everything's in Castle Rock. God, if it's like, yeah, I'm thinking of moving to the Northeast. I'm not looking for real estate in Castle Rock.
That is exactly right.
Very cool. Our final review is Nuclear Winter 68 from Lock and Load Publishing, designed by Petra Tutunia.
I bless you.
I was going to say, I'm hoping I didn't completely butcher that. It is from this year. It is for 1 to 3 players. You can usually get a game in within about 60 minutes or so. It's suggested for ages 12 and up and retails for $39.99. So it's actually one of the lower priced Lock and Load games.
Yeah, that's cool.
Nuclear Winter is a new war game from Lock and Load, and it's set in an alternate history in which Operation Valkyrie succeeded and Adolf Hitler was assassinated. Following Hitler's death, Heinrich Himmler, another lunatic of extreme proportions, takes control of Germany and becomes Führer. Himmler understands the importance of the race for the atomic bomb and renews efforts for Reich research. Near about the same time in 1945, Himmler learns of plans to drop the big one on Germany once the U.S. has the atomic bomb and begins production of massive underground shelters to hold many of the Fatherland's elite units for years on end. In April of 1946, the Allies finally land in France, but turn out to be repulsed by the Axis forces, which leads U.S. President Harry S. Truman to drop the first atomic bomb in history on April 17th, not on Hiroshima, but Frankfurt. This leads Himmler to issue orders for the predetermined elite units to disengage the enemy and begin entering the newly constructed bunkers throughout Germany. The Führer does so as well, and his final order on the surface is to put Operation Clausewitz into action, the V2 atomic bombing of London and Paris. The U.S. responds by dropping nukes on Berlin, Hamburg, Munich, and Dusseldorf. Germany collapses and becomes a nuclear wasteland. In 1947, the Allies aren't able to control the flood of refugees fleeing Germany and decide to build a wall around what they call the nuclear zone. And that's finished by early 1948. At the same time, the world's ecosystem is thrown into turmoil as nuclear winter sets in. In 1952, the first attempts of a breakout from the nuclear zone take place, and strange reports come back from soldiers that there are enemy fighters who have to be shot apart before they die. And then, in the morning after the attack, there's no bodies to be found. NATO is formed to combat the growing threat from the nuclear zone. And in this version of NATO, it's the Western European countries, the U.S., and Russia. In 1955, low-level reconnaissance of the zone reveals some shocking information. There are human settlements throughout the landscape, and there's strange creatures that roam the wasteland. By 1960, environmental specialists estimate the Earth is beginning to see the ebb of the nuclear winter as temperatures around the globe begin to increase, while new recon of the zone shows a blighted landscape of ruin marked by dead vegetation and dried-up toxic rivers. It's into this landscape of devastation that an aged Himmler and the remnants of the Third Reich emerged from their hidden bunkers in 1968. Determined to rebuild the Holy Roman Empire, Himmler, who has absolutely no idea what's been going on the surface, finds himself facing the strange creatures that now inhabit the nuclear zone, as well as a U.S.-Russian-NATO task force that's been sent to investigate. This is the situation you find yourself in as Nuclear Winter 68 opens.
Huh. Who comes up with this stuff?
Well, it wasn't Mark Walker, although I would have to take a guess that Mark's got a lot to do with the background story of the game.
Yeah, Nazi mutants. I love
it. Well, no, it's not really. The mutants are completely different.
Okay.
And they're called the Black Hand.
Ah.
The Black Spot. Upon opening the box, you're going to find the components are up to the usual lock and load standards. There's nice glossy counters, and it has a mounted map. One thing to point out, unlike many of the lock and load titles, the map isn't modular, so it's not broken up into pieces that you can arrange in various ways, but it's actually one big mounted map of a set area of the zone. The 40-page rulebook is very nicely put together and presented in a way which pretty much makes sense. Although there's one thing I have to point out about the rulebook, it's not the easiest to read, as in visually not easy. The color palette of the game uses a lot of drab browns because it is a wasteland.
Uh-huh.
The rulebook background is this same weird olive brownish color with black text on top, so it takes your eyes a lot of time to get adjusted. I found myself having to reread large portions of the rules because my brain just wasn't processing the info properly, just because it just looks so weird. Yeah. It's just tough to differentiate. I got to be honest, I don't know what Mark Walker was thinking with this color selection, but I'm hoping it's a graphic design that will not be present in future print runs or other games that might be released in this line. If you have any experience with almost any of Lock and Load's war games, especially the Forgotten Heroes series, you're not going to have any problem settling right into Nuclear Winter 68, as it shares many of the mechanics of other titles. Various infantry, armor, air, and support units are organized by formations, and activation is by chit pull, although one side can never activate more than two formations in a row. This creates a good deal of tension as you're never sure when you're going to get a particular formation into gear, unless it's the last chit waiting to be pulled out of the cup, of course. Also, going first isn't necessarily always a good thing because your enemies will have the opportunity to perform opportunity attacks as you move into range. The game is a little bit easier than some of the lock and load games that are out there because there's no spotting rules. So some of the games, especially Forgotten Heroes of Vietnam, You have to actually spot the unit that's there, the counter that's there. You have to spot it. You have to roll to spot it before you can attack it. That doesn't apply. So in this game, if it's in your line of sight and it's in range, you can blow it to hell.
Sweet.
Combat's pretty straightforward, and formations can have command units attached, which provide additional benefits in combat or help in rallying shaken units. Nuclear Winter 68 isn't a difficult game to play by any stretch, and makes a great introduction into the lock and load line of titles. You have tanks, armored personnel carriers, airplanes, helicopters, offboard artillery, weird mutant units, fanatical Nazis, and a plethora of wild things going on. Biggest selling point of the game, in my opinion, is the scenarios. There's 15, and they're played in chronological order, and they create a narrative as the Germans emerge from their bunkers. The scenarios can also be linked together into separate campaigns for each of the factions, the Germans, NATO, and the Black Hand.
Arr.
Some of the scenarios even showcase all three of the factions, so you can have three player games. The game also does well as a solitaire game because nothing's hidden. Everything's right out there on the map. The activation is by chip pull, so it's not as if you have hidden units or fog of war. Another nice thing is most of the scenarios get you right into the action right off the bat. So there isn't a whole lot of edging up into battle and getting everything all prepared. You're pretty much slugging it out right from the onset. I highly recommend Nuclear Winter 68, and it's a bit of a departure, especially in theme, for lock and load. If you're a fan of other lock and load games, I'm going to guarantee you're really going to dig this one as well. If you've never given any of the games from Lock and Load a try, this is a really nice title to make your acquaintance. There's loads of theme, great scenarios, the factions are pretty well balanced, and an excellent time can be had by all.
Nice. This is one that I am really looking forward to getting a chance to try.
It's a pretty cool game. I really did like it. Some of the scenarios have some random events that can take place. And I know when I reviewed Forgotten Heroes of Vietnam, there were some events in that as well. And the one thing I didn't like about the random events there is there weren't a whole lot of different events that could take place. There would be an event token on the map, and once you'd get there, two, maybe three different events could take place. Sometimes it was just like the one that always happened, if I remember correctly. On this, you'll actually roll two dice, and you have a chart that has different random events on it. So it shakes it up a lot.
Oh, that's cool.
In this game, the Nazis aren't just the typical knee-jerk enemy. They're the baddest of the bad guys. In reality, it's the Black Hand.
Really?
Who's the big baddies, yeah. And some of the units the Black Hand has are pretty bizarre. They're mutants.
Right.
Yeah, it's a very cool game. Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely check it out. It's going to go up there on our top games list. I'll tell you that right now.
Nice.
There you have it. That's our show for this time around. Elliot, anything else that you wanted to share with the audience?
No, happy Mother's Day out there. I can't remember when Mother's Day is, but I know it's in May.
I think it's before our next show, isn't
there it? There you go. I'm right on the ball.
I know it's on a Sunday.
There might be one or two moms who hear our podcast. Who knows?
Yeah. So happy Mother's Day to anybody's mom out there.
Yep.
One thing I was going to ask, any games that are currently on the horizon that we'll be seeing reviews of soon?
See, I've got the Walking Dead board game from Cryptozoic. Haven't played Dreadfleet yet, which I'm looking forward to. I picked that one up.
There we go.
And you know, I forgot all about Antiquity.
Ah, you finally got it.
Yes, I got it.
Your $500 game, right?
It was like probably one of the most expensive I've ever bought.
And you cracked it open, and what was your initial thoughts? I have to ask.
There is a lot of cardboard in there.
I mean, there's like $120 worth of cardboard. Right?
Yeah, it's a little intimidating when you open it up. I mean, the box itself is the size of a small table, so you could almost use it as a coffee table game, kind of like Kramer.
Wow. Hey, now you know how big the box for that designer's edition of Ogre is. I bet you it's probably about the same size.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right.
Very cool. I should ask, have you had a chance to play the Walking Dead computer game that just came out?
I have not had a chance to try it yet. I hear you
have. The first chapter?
Yeah.
Yep, I did a review of it. I liked it. I thought it was pretty cool. But as far as what I've got coming up, I would say probably by the next show, I will have Virgin Queen from GMT. Also, Adventures Under the Laughing Moon role-playing game. That should be reviewed next time around. And who knows, maybe even some Dystopian Wars. So there you have it. Until next time, thanks for listening. And Elliot, care to take us out?
Yep. You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message.
If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.